God's rules for life have reached a temporary hiatus. The Bible narrative has parked itself on top of a mountain east of Egypt and appears to be stuck there for the foreseeable. God is sharing with Moses the rules by which his people are to live. If you're Jewish, Muslim, or Christian, these are hugely important. Even if you're not, the rules are interesting simply because they are so old, yet have survived so many generations and seismic cultural shifts. However, God has paused the laws that define human behaviour and social justice and is now laying down a blueprint for a fabulous portable temple and the furnishings that are to go inside it. The sense is that God is a God above all gods and must be worshipped appropriately. He needs to be front and centre of his people's lives, and so daily life must revolve around serving and honouring him. God's demands for the accoutrements needed to carry out this worship are astonishing in their scale and imagination, and it would be a tough ask to pull them all together in a well-resourced city. Yet Moses and his cohort of freed slaves must make all this happen in the middle of the Sinai Desert. My name is Chaz Bayfield, and this is Holy Bible, Episode 23, Emerald and Amethyst. It's amazing you're all still here. This section of the Bible is quite dry when compared to the full-throttle adventure of the escape from Egypt. As we push on, you'll realise that the Bible has peaks and troughs when it comes to action sequences, but the only action here is an 80-year-old man repeatedly ascending and descending a mountain, taking messages he receives from God back to the Israelite camp. There's a lot of detail and a lot of religion, and this is a section of the Bible largely ignored by the Christian church. The template for a canvas temple and its portable furnishings isn't seen as uplifting or life-affirming, and it seems low on teachable moments. Happily, Holy Bible's mission is not to teach. We simply tell and marvel at the detail. So on that note, let's return to the mountain. God has yet to share his grand plans for his worship tent, but it needs other furniture to facilitate all the offerings that need to be made to God. One of these items is a gold-plated table. The core of the table is acacia wood, and like the ark, it needs golden rings and poles to make it portable. There is a sense that nothing is permanent here in the desert, and like modern-day camping gear, everything needs to be carried around easily. The table is relatively small, 3 feet by 1 foot 6 inches and 2 foot 3 inches high. For those of you who like your measurements in metric, I've put all these in the show notes. Golden dishes, plates and jugs should sit on this table, as should something which God describes as the bread of the presence. This food is also known as showbread and sits on the table as a permanent offering to God. Again, offering food to gods appears to be common practice in ancient Near Eastern cultures. God describes in intricate detail how he wants the lampstand in his tent or tabernacle to look. As anyone who has ever seen a Jewish menorah knows, this has a central stem and 3 pairs of U-shaped branches, making 7 lamps in all. The candelabra is intricately carved with almond flowers, buds and lilies, 4 sets on the central stem and 3 on the other 6. A golden bud should sit where the 3 pairs of lamps join the central column. God gives no reason why the lampstand should have buds or flowers, or what the significance of almonds might be, but much of the temple paraphernalia seems to take its reference from existing religious codes and worshipping regalia. The lamps that hold the oil and wicks are to be set so that they illuminate everything in front of the lampstand, and all the wick trimmers and their trays should be fashioned out of gold too. The sheer complexity of the lampstand's design suggests that God expects only the absolute best from his people. An entire talent of gold should be used to manufacture this fabulously ornate piece of lighting. This ancient Hebrew unit of measurement appears throughout the Bible and equates to around 130 pounds. As the Israelites are in transit, no permanent building can be erected in which to worship God. The tabernacle commissioned by God is without doubt the most elaborate and ostentatious tent ever imagined. This portable canvas and animal skin temple will allow the Israelites to worship God in the desert appropriately. The briefing for its construction takes in all the building materials and accoutrements required, as well as the correct workwear for the priests. The tabernacle is a blueprint for the temple that will eventually be built by Solomon in Jerusalem, and all the details of how to behave inside it are spelled out by God to Moses on top of the mountain. The tabernacle itself is a giant marquee made from blue, purple, and red cloth with cherubim woven into it. These, you may remember from earlier episodes, are the ferocious angel-like creatures who guarded the gates of the Garden of Eden to prevent Adam and Eve from returning back inside. 10 equally sized curtains, each with 50 loops at either end, are to be linked together with golden clasps, 5 curtains on one side and 5 on the other. Splitting the canvas of the tabernacle into 10 parts helps with its portability, and the clasps can be easily undone when it needs to be dismantled. Each curtain is around 42 feet long and 6 feet high, and when linked together, the fabric covering is draped over a more solid internal wooden structure. An outer skin of animal hides is constructed in the same way. At 45 feet, the hides are slightly longer, and there's an extra 11th curtain. This extra length is to hang over the back of the tent, while at the front, the hide is to be folded back on itself to form a neat edge. Over this go 2 more layers, one of red ramskins and another of more durable leather, possibly from the skin of sea mammals such as manatees or dugongs. The central frame of the tabernacle is made from planks of acacia wood 15 feet high and 2 foot 3 inches wide. Each is covered in gold and has pegs projecting from the end that can be set into a solid silver base. The planks are arranged side by side vertically, and a series of golden loops are attached to each one so that a horizontal pole can be slid through to hold them all in place. This bar is also gold-plated. Form is as important as function in this particular construction. There are 20 planks on either side of the tabernacle and 6 at the end, making a rectangular structure around 45 feet long by 13 foot 6 inches wide. Being so holy, the ark needs to be separated from the rest of the tent. To achieve this, God commissions an ornate curtain made from blue, crimson and purple thread with a cherubim design woven into it. 4 gold-plated wooden posts with hooks in them are to support the curtain, which divides the inner space in 2. The ark is to be placed in the protected area behind the curtain, and the 2 spaces are given names. In front of the curtain is the holy place, while behind it is the most holy place. The solid gold mercy seat, which now has a 3rd name, the atonement cover, is to be placed on top of the ark. Later, God will commission an entire day dedicated to atonement, where the Israelites fast and offer sacrifices in exchange for forgiveness from God. This day is still honoured by Jews today and is known as Yom Kippur. The table is to be placed on the other side of the curtain to the ark and sits against the wall that faces north. Opposite it on the south side sits the lampstand. Over the entrance or portico is another curtain supported by vertical wooden posts overlaid with gold and set in bases of bronze. The tabernacle is a huge commission, but one that breaks down into a multitude of portable parts and which will serve the Israelites for centuries until they finally have a temple built out of stone. It's impossible to make sacrifices to God without an altar, and this time a heap of rough stones won't cut it. God's altar is suitably impressive. It resembles a giant barbecue and stands 4 foot 6 inches high and is 7 foot 6 inches square. It is to be built using acacia wood and must sport a carved horn at each corner. The altar should be coated in bronze, and all the tools to be used on it must also be bronze. These include scuttles and shovels to remove the ashes, bowls to sprinkle the blood, forks to roast the meat, and pans used to carry burning embers to a second altar where incense will be burned. The griddle is to be made from bronze, and like every other large item in the tabernacle, it is to have rings at each corner to make it portable. It is set into the box on a specially made ledge, and the altar itself is to be carried with bronze-plated poles inserted into rings at its side. The tabernacle is to be separated from the rest of the Israelite camp by its own courtyard. This fence is made from woven linen, supported by wooden posts set into solid bronze bases, and should extend 150 feet either side of the tent. The curtain wall across the 2 narrow ends is 75 feet long, but the end facing east towards the sunrise should have a separate entry curtain. This distinctive entrance is to be 40 feet wide and woven from blue, purple and scarlet thread. Extending either side of this entrance should be curtains made from the same plainer linen as the rest of the courtyard. Moses is told to instruct the Israelites to bring clear olive oil, which will keep the lamps on the golden lampstand burning throughout the night. The pure olive oil for the lamps is obtained by merely bruising the olives and letting the oil drip out rather than crushing them and applying heat. The job of keeping the lamps alight is delegated to Aaron and his sons, the first suggestion that Israel's priesthood is to be a hereditary one. The command is to keep the light going during the hours of darkness, but the 1st century AD Jewish historian Josephus describes how the lamps are kept burning in the temple night and day, even though daylight should have made this unnecessary for much of the time. The attention now turns from the inanimate fixtures and fittings to the garments worn by the men who will be officiating inside the tabernacle. It's at this point that God commissions Aaron and his four sons to be Israel's priests. Aaron needs to be treated with dignity and honour by the rest of Israel, he says, which means that he must be suitably attired. It appears that God has already given a set of workers the requisite skills to make the costume, and these men are to be commissioned by Moses to complete their work. When Moses' brother puts on these clothes, it will be seen as an act of dedication. The sense is that God is choosing him to be the spiritual leader of his people. Exodus calls this act of dedication consecration. The garments to be worn by Aaron include a metal breastplate, an ephod, a kind of waistcoat, a robe, a tunic, a turban, and a sash. The clothes are to be made with gold, blue, scarlet, and purple thread, and the finest quality linen. The blue of the high priest's garments is a unique dye made from a single breed of mollusk, possibly the rock snail or murex, while the scarlet will have come from a worm called Sirmes vermilio, better known as the scarlet worm. These are hard to find, especially in the desert, and great value will have been attached to them in Old Testament times. The ephod has a waistband and shoulder pads into which are set onyx stones. One stone is to sit in a gold filigree setting on each shoulder epaulette, and the names of six of Jacob's sons are to be engraved in birth order on one stone and six on the other. According to God, the stones are a permanent memorial to the men whose families became the 12 tribes of what is now the nation of Israel. At the front of the ephod is a square breastpiece into which are set 12 precious stones: carnelian, chrysolite and beryl, turquoise, lapis lazuli and emerald, jacinth, agate and amethyst, and topaz, onyx and jasper. For those unfamiliar with gemstones, carnelian is reddish-brown, chrysolite is olive-green, and beryl is aquamarine. Jacinth is reddish-brown, agates come in a variety of colours, and amethyst is purple. Topaz is colourless, but when heated can become orange, pale green, pink, purple, or deep blue. Onyx is generally black or white, while jasper can be red, yellow, brown, or green. The stones are mounted on gold filigree settings, and each has the name of one of the 12 tribal leaders etched into it. The breastpiece is attached with gold chains to the shoulder pads and the waistband of the ephod. This particular garment is also known as the breastpiece of decision, as it contains a pocket in which is stored the Urim and Thummim, a kind of divining device used by the high priest to determine the mind of God. This mysterious apparatus sits over the priest's heart and is believed to consist of a set of gemstones, though how they are used, readers are not told. It's likely that the stones might be thrown like dice, and the formation of how they land leads to a simple yes-no, good-bad answer. It's unusual that the Urim and Thummim are never properly described in the Bible, especially as so much detail goes into the rest of the priest's outfit and the tabernacle. However, many decisions in Old Testament times are based on a high priest using these tools, often at the request of a king. Over the ephod is worn a blue robe, whose hem is adorned with blue, purple and scarlet pomegranates, interspersed with golden bells. The bells serve a practical function. Their tinkling assures God that the man who has entered into his presence is his priest, and so he knows not to kill him. In Old Testament times, no mortal can look at God and live. Only Aaron is permitted to enter behind the curtain to the most holy place where the ark is kept, and the tinkling of the bells will also reassure those on the other side that he is not only doing his job, but that he is still alive. On Aaron's head will be placed a turban that has a golden plate at the front attached to it with a blue cord. On the plate is to be written, "Holy to the Lord." The sense is that the Israelites might sometimes offer impure or inadequate gifts as sacrifices, and this headpiece transfers the guilt to Aaron, thereby pacifying God. Christians see this as a precursor to Jesus, who they believe takes away the impurities from all his followers so that God sees them as perfect. As outfits go, Aaron's is a complete showstopper, and the effect of its splendour on the nomadic Israelite wanderers living a very basic life in the Sinai wilderness can only be imagined. Aaron's sons also need to be dressed in a way that encourages people to honour them and treat them with respect. Their outfits are considerably less elaborate than their father's and consist of linen tunics with sashes and caps. Once they're suitably attired, the four priests are to be anointed, which suggests having oil or animal blood sprinkled on their clothing. They are also to be ordained and consecrated, a ceremony which Exodus goes into more detail about later. It appears that showing private parts to God is a faux pas that incurs death, even if accidental. To keep their dignity and their lives, should their nether regions ever be exposed, the priests are ordered to wear linen breeches. The understanding from this is that the average layperson in Israel wanders around commando. It's quite a prosaic way to end a description of one of the most fabulous costumes ever imagined, but it throws valuable insight into everyday clothing in the Near East 3,500 years ago. Before they begin their roles as Israel's priests, Aaron and his sons have to undergo a solemn initiation. Acting as a conduit between God and his people is seen as hugely important, and the men can't be expected to just pick up the role and run with it. First, God needs a basket of food. The basket must contain thick and thin yeast-free loaves made with the finest flour and olive oil, as well as meat from a bull and two rams, which have no physical imperfection. Aaron and his sons are to be brought to the entrance of the tabernacle, where they should be washed with water. Aaron should then be dressed in the ornate garments prepared for him. The ephod is to be fastened by the waistband, and the turban and its emblem placed on his head. Oil is to be poured on his head to signify that he has been chosen by God. Aaron's sons are to be dressed in their simpler tunics and caps, and God promises that they will be priests in perpetuity, suggesting that their male descendants will also serve in the tabernacle and later the temple. Once this has been done, it's time to ordain Aaron and his sons. This is an intricate and quite gory ceremony, and one that involves slaughtering bulls and splashing around blood. It's hard to know what Moses must be thinking. God may have an extensive shopping list, but he appears not to be taking into account the reality of the Israelites' current situation. They are in a desert having fled Egypt, but somehow need to provide dyes made from sea snails and hides from sea cows, as well as sourcing some of the rarest gemstones on the planet. It's a huge ask, and Moses currently has no idea who he is going to commission to make any of this happen. But God is far from finished, and continues to reel off his list of wants to his human messenger, as far below, the rest of Israel waits to know what their next move might be. Holy Bible is written and produced by me, Chaz Bayfield, with music by Michael Old and John Hawkins Music. Cover art is by Lisa Goff. Please send any comments and feedback to contact@holybible.com.